Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Good morning, everyone. I'm thinking on this September 11th, 2009, about how we're becoming kind of a bifurcated city around the memory of the attacks. I think we're increasingly divided into those who were personally affected and those who were not. For those who were not, is the idea of 9/11 itself becoming a little remote? Is it a day now to stop for a minute or two and pay respects to the heroes and to the lost? But that's all, and then to look away and say, I don't want to think about it, because it is hard to think about it. And if you don't have to confront it, many people choose not to. Well, for those who were there, or those who lost your husbands or your fathers or your wives or mothers or brothers or sisters, the pain doesn't really go away. And the anniversary just rubs the wound raw again. Of course, we don't neatly fall into two camps, but does it tend toward that direction, do you think? 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692, or post to WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. Our first call-in today will be for anyone who did lose someone personally close to you on September 11th. Do you feel isolated, maybe increasingly isolated from others on this anniversary day? Are you wanting to shout, never forget, because you have no choice but to remember, and you see others beginning to forget. Our phones are open for anyone who personally lost someone in the attacks. 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. And if you were a witness to that day in any way, the National September 11th Memorial and Museum wants your story. They launched a website just yesterday built around hundreds of photos and videos that they've collected of the day of the attacks and thereabouts. Their mission here is to memorialize the day for future generations and for all time using the best technology we have today and collecting images not just from professional news or arts organizations but from everyone who documented that highly documented day. And we're going to talk about that right now as your calls are coming in with Michael Shulin, creative director for the National September 11th Memorial and Museum, and Jake Barton, founder and principal of Local Projects, an award-winning media design firm which consults museums and public spaces and which is involved in this project as well. So Michael and Jake, thank you very much for coming in today. Welcome to WNYC.
Thanks for having us.
The website, Michael, is makehistory.national911memorial.org, or we have a link on our page, WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show.
And you can also go to 911history.org, which will connect you to the other URL.
I didn't realize that was there. 911history.org. And some of you may want to actually go there right now and look at some of the images that we'll be discussing. And I think most people by now, Michael, want to look away, as I was saying, from images of 9/11, not to look at them. And I wonder if you're doing your project at all to counter that reaction or just simply with an eye to a much more distant future.
Well, we're doing our project, first of all, because our mission is to document the event and begin to make sense of the event. And really, our scope is much larger than the event itself, although really we're focusing on the scope as our jumping off point. But 9/11, the event may be over, but the repercussions of 9/11 are still with us every day. And really, it's incumbent, I think, upon all of us to if not to remember all of the searing horror of the day, to live with those issues as we do and to think about them all the time.
Jake, tell us about the Make History site. Anyone can collect images. What's the idea behind this particular collection and what you're trying to do with it?
Sure. So 911history.org is a worldwide call for photos, videos, and stories, both of the day of the attacks and the aftermath. We understood the day from a personal moment when it actually happened, but the reality is for each individual moment, there are literally millions, if not billions, of individual moments of understanding the horror of that day. It's estimated that 2 billion people, a third of the world, witnessed the day in real time within 24 hours.
Meaning watching on television or something else.
Exactly. And there's an incredible similarity of people's stories from the U.S. to Japan to England. But there's also an incredible individualism and diversity. And the museum really wants to tell that global story, but quite literally doesn't have the ability to gather those stories in any other way.
We're going to hear a couple of clips of audio from your collection in just a minute, but let's talk to a couple of our listeners. John in Glen Cove, you're on WNYC. John, thanks so much for calling.
Well, thanks so much for taking my call. I lost my brother the day of the attacks. He was a firefighter. And I do feel somewhat isolated. I imagine it's similar to people who have lost loved ones in the Holocaust, you know, many, many years ago. You know, there's a tremendous desire to not have people forget what happened that day, how for some of us it's a very personal thing. I tell you, I have to say that I'm almost a bit offended by the president's call for a day of public service rather than a day of mourning. Having a day of public service is a great thing, and certainly my brother died trying to save lives, but as someone who has lost someone dear to them, I'd rather us be mourning today than worrying about giving to other people.
Are they mutually exclusive?
You know, I on an intellectual level, I guess they're not mutually exclusive. But as I said, unless you've lived through it on a very personal level, it's kind of hard to describe the feelings I have. And you know, on an intellectual level, I think it's a great way to remember the people that died and the people that died giving by giving to other people. But as this day draws closer, my heart just sinks more and more. And by the time the day comes, you know, I've got nothing left in me to give.
For yourself, you know? John, how do you observe the day?
I try my best to not wallow in remorse. You know, I can't help but, you know, listen to some of what's going on the radio. I watch the TV. I see the names being read. But for the most part, I try to just go on with life and just silently, from time to time, give him some thoughts, much as I do my father, who died of leukemia years ago. You know, things will happen during the day where he'll pop in my head and I'll stop for a minute and give him a thought. But I try pretty much to continue with my life.
John, thank you very much for calling. I appreciate you giving public voice to these thoughts, and I'm sorry for your loss.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and we continue with Jake Barton, founder and principal of Local Projects, an award-winning media design firm which consults museums and public spaces, and in this case, the National September 11th Memorial and Museum. We also have Michael Shulin here, the creative director for the National September 11th Memorial and Museum. And we'll take more of your phone calls. If you lost someone personally close to you on 9/11, do you, like like John, feel isolated on this day from those who did not lose someone personally as much of the world moves on? And in fact, next hour we'll be talking to someone specifically about President Obama's call to make 9/11 a day of national service, and we'll get some more reactions at that time to John and Glen Cove being offended by the president wanting to make it a day of service rather than a day of grief. Michael, I have an audio clip from your collection. This is about a minute and a half of a story told by Hiro Oshima, who had an apartment in a building right next to the World Trade Center.
Right.
And we pick this up after he's come to the window of his apartment after the first plane hit.
I saw debris, pieces of building debris and plane all over the sidewalk, including an office chair that was embedded into the back of a car. I hear the second plane. It sounds like a missile that's coming down on us. Now there's a gaping, burning hole in the side of the south tower. Go back into my apartment, at which point I start hearing another screeching that sounds similar but louder, and then the explosion, and everything goes silent. The black, dark debris of smoke covering my entire apartment into pitch black, and we climb down the fire escape to the ground level in the lobby where it's all covered in dust and smoke. Announcement is made that the fire department will be evacuating us as soon as the smoke clears. We get the order. Everybody starts walking down calmly. We're told that we'll be evacuated to Battery Park and out of the island. As we're walking down, we hear the next screeching. The falling tower is coming down on top of us. Everybody starts to run. We reach the Battery Park, and that's when the smoke catches up to us. So we can't see anything. Boats start to arrive, ferry boats, tugboats, police boats, personal boats. People are told to get on. We got on a small tugboat. As we were being pulled out, for the first time, you could look back through clear sky and see the island completely engulfed in smoke. It looked like the entire island was burning.
And after 9/11, he wandered the city for 3 days. The story continues. We don't have time to play his full audio file, but he ended up staying with a college friend in the East Village. He wasn't able to access his apartment until December, and he returned only once to retrieve a few belongings, then moved permanently away and hasn't returned since. So, Michael Chelonier, you want to talk about that story in particular?
Well, the first thing, obviously, to say is that this is a track which accompanies images which are on the website.
Uh-huh.
But the other thing to say is that really we are making a museum, and the website is the first preview of that, in which personal documents feature very importantly in narratives, so that this is an example of a narrative. We have many more of them. We're receiving them on the website, many thousands, in fact, since yesterday. And we're very excited about this, and this is the kind of museum that we're making.
And so what effect are you going for there, Jake? I mean, are there, when this is actually on display, when the museum opens, I guess, next year is what you're hoping?
2012.
2012. Okay, right. So still 3 years from now. Mm-hmm. Then people will come and they'll hear Hero's story.
They'll hear a wide variety of individual stories.
While seeing images that accompany a story like this.
Exactly. The key storytelling idea here is that it's not about a single historic narrative that's going to be plunked down in front of visitors. It's really about seeing history being created by each individual experience. So in this case, for the website, what we're doing is we're gathering each of these individual photographs, videos, stories, and visitors to the website can browse them individually. They can gather them by themes or by location, by time of day. They can see the same street corner of Manhattan after the first attack, after the second attack, after the first tower went down, the second tower, a week afterwards, a month afterwards, and a year afterwards. They can see the unveiling and the movement of time and history through different locations.
Joseph is calling from Brussels, Belgium. Joseph, hello from New York. Thank you for calling in. Why are you listening to us today?
I'm listening to you here on the internet, actually. I listen to you just about every day, as long as I was in New York up until the last couple of weeks when I moved to Belgium.
That's great.
One thing I want to mention, something that you mentioned a little while ago, that it's beginning to disappear from the ethos of New Yorkers, and I think people naturally and internationally. I grew up in New York. I lived in Queens until about 2001. We lived in West Harlem up until the last couple of weeks. And it was always in the front of our mind, in the forefront of our mind. And, you know, walking down the street or even going into the subway or anywhere where you're in a large group of people. And I worked with a national company. Whenever I mentioned to them that I was from New York, up until about 2004, it was, oh, wow, you were from New York. What was that like? Where were you? How does it feel like? By about 2005, I stopped getting those questions. And up until recently, no one even mentions it anymore. And it's not the kind of thing that you want to keep forcing down people's throats. But to New Yorkers, it's an ever-present reality. Outside of New York, and even over here in Europe, not so much.
Joseph, thank you for that. And I wonder if Americans in general, as they travel around the world, have that feeling of this fading away. Michael, do you want to say something about that?
Certainly, it is right that it not be always in the forefront of everyone's minds. Mm-hmm. And, of course, New York and the world has changed since 2001, since 9/11. But it's important that we remember this because, of course, these issues are still with us. And it fades away in a certain way, but the residue of 9/11 is very much still with us, and that's really why we're making this museum, both to commemorate what happened and to explore the ongoing story.
Some comments from our Facebook group. Melissa writes, the weather from that morning and the smells from that afternoon will always stay with me. After 9/11, it hurt to feel the perfect weather of a late summer morning on my skin and to see a spotless, clear blue sky. How wonderful it felt to walk to my new job at an office in Chelsea just minutes before it happened, and how terrifying it was to walk home across the Manhattan Bridge with throngs of silent, nervous, heartbroken New Yorkers. Mm-hmm. Joseph in the Bronx, you're on WNYC. Hi, Joseph.
Yeah, Brian, please don't take my comment in the wrong way. Nobody talks about the soldiers. I have two friends that they lost their life in Iraq. I mean, we are making a lot of big deal out of this 9/11. We got to think about the soldier, the policy after that. What has done to this country? What has done to our soul? Nobody talks about that.
Joseph,
and
thank you.
I'm very disappointed with everyone, including yourself, that doesn't talk. We're what we call commercializing 9/11. Forgetting about all these soldiers that are going to continue dying in two wars, which was cleared after 9/11. Nobody talks about them. What is the value of their life?
Joseph,
I'm
really glad you brought it up. It's actually something we're going to dwell on more in depth a little later in the program.
It's also something that we're going to talk about in the museum. The soldiers are very important, and they made a great sacrifice.
Well, this is a question that I have for you, because there was so much controversy over even the idea of context at all at the 9/11 Memorial and Museum.
Sure.
There was such a right-wing backlash against the idea of contextualizing it, and rather than just narrowly focusing on the attack and the loss. And how is it winding up?
Well, we start and we assert, first of all, the primacy of the event and the primacy of the site. And we are a memorial museum, so our first obligation, obviously, is to the victims and to their families and to the story. But it's obvious, but we also have an obligation to tell the history and to record, to examine the truth, which we need to do in a respectful and an appropriate way. But 9/11 didn't come out of nowhere. It was an act of murder, and it was done by people who had rationales for doing it. And these things need to be exposed, and so we will tell those stories. But we're very conscious that we need to do so in an appropriate way and to contextualize it very carefully. And this is part of our mission, and it's something we're spending a lot of time thinking about before we open.
Michael Shulin and Jake Barton from the National September 11th Memorial and Museum, now collecting images of 9/11, your photos, your videos, your stories at their website, which again is
911history.org.
Here's another audio bite from one of the things there. This is a story told by a man named George Moronis, who worked as an office manager for a bank on the 48th floor of the North Tower. And he talks about how he always got to work early, and he was in the building at 8:46 when the first plane hit 50 floors above him.
And I looked out the window immediately, and I saw a lot of debris was coming down. And I felt the floor moving ahead of me and back. I ran real quickly to see if any people were there. Back to my desk, I took a quick picture from the window, and that's when I left. But like halfway down, finally came in up. One fireman tells me, don't worry, we're going to be okay. But he pat me on my shoulder a moment. Then we got lowered to the main concourse of the building, stepping on nothing but glass that was all over the lobby. Then we got out to a side door, which led us to the plaza when I went outside in the corner. I saw a lady, she was screaming, and people are there. By the post office corner, looking for co-workers or friends, screaming, crying. I turned around quickly and I looked at the number two building. From the way it stood, it cracked to the left, and I kept looking there. Within seconds, it started coming down, and I started running. I kept looking behind me, and I ended up on the east side. Only the ferry boats were available. It took me 3.5 hours after I got on the line to get on the ferry boat. The ferry was packed. I kept looking behind me, and I looked at the smoke of the towers. Then I ended up at a pier, which is in Weehawken, New Jersey. I went back the following week to the site. Then I stopped by St. Paul's Church. They had on the fence photographs with different people of missing persons. By the church's entrance to the left, I noticed the picture of the fireman who spoke to me as I was coming down the staircase. I looked and I said, this cannot be, but I look again. And it was that face that spoke to me and pat me on my shoulder. And I said, well, no. I started crying because the guy who spoke to me didn't make it. I do go even now to the site weekly, and I leave a glass candle there by the firehouse number 10, which is right across from the site.
And as we hear, George Moronis continues to visit the site weekly, and he was part of the relief efforts in the days and weeks following the attacks. Another example from the collection being put together by the National September 11th Memorial and Museum, looking directly at, not averting their eyes or our ears or hearts or minds as we sit here on the 8th anniversary of the September 11th attacks. Jake Barton, just tell people, since you are really collecting stuff, what you want people to contribute to you.
I think that it's important on this day of remembrance to also be aware that there were vigils in London, Berlin, in Tokyo, in Tehran. These are events that the entire world mourned with the United States, as well as witnessing it. And the museum really wants to be able to tell those stories. And to do that, we're doing this worldwide call. If you have photos, if you have videos, if you have contacts or people across the U.S. or across the world, go to 911history.org. And as we collect these things, this is quite literally how we will be making history.
Michael Shulin, creative director for the National September 11th Memorial and Museum. Jake Barton, founder and principal of Local Projects, which is consulting the museum. Thank you both very much, and good luck with the project.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This is always one of the toughest hours of the year to be on the air, and yet one of the most important. This show happens to be live at 10 a.m., which is the hour that both towers collapsed, and 8 years ago today, actually 9:59, just as we're about to begin, and then 10:29, this is the hour when most of the people died. They died, of course, when the towers collapsed. And we've always observed a moment of silence in those minutes, as we are doing again today. So we will be quiet in just a minute here when we reach 10:29. And then we'll take your calls on what the most accessible emotion is for you on this anniversary. Is it grief? Is it anger? As Joseph in the Bronx was articulating, is it determination to change the world for the better? What thought is top of mind, and seriously, what emotion is top of heart for you today, and what related issue? We'll take those calls in a little bit at 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. You can call in now and get in line, or post to WNYC.org, click on Brian Lehrer Show. And let's go live to the World Trade Center site right now at 10:28. Listen to a few of the names of the dead being read, and then we'll join them for a brief moment of silence. They are in the moment of silence right now. To a musical interlude at the ceremony at Ground Zero. WNYC's Matthew Sherman is there, where the names of the dead have been read all morning, as has become the tradition. Matthew, what's it like there today?
It's cold, rainy, windy. It's not a great day, I imagine, for the families anyway, but to sit through 4 hours is probably not the most comfortable commemoration this year compared to years past.
It's so eerie that it's raining and miserable today. I mean, it reflects the misery that the mourners must feel, but it's also so different from the eerie beauty and blue sky warmth of the day of the attacks. I wonder, I don't know if you've been down there for this ceremony in past years, but I wonder if it feels different from previous September 11ths in that respect, in ways you can put into words.
I think it does. A couple of people I've spoken with said that it is appropriate that the day is a little bit more somber just weather-wise today compared to years past, that there is this sort of, you know, atmospheric expression, I guess, of grief and what have you. I've been actually struck by how many people, even those who just work in the area, who didn't necessarily know anybody who was killed in the attack, how many people, how solemn they are, how much they're thinking about this today, and how they still really remember where they were and what happened today, and that's what they're thinking about.
Who's reading the names this year?
The family members, and I guess the special angle this year is the volunteers who went down and helped out in the days and months after the attack.
And elected officials are there as usual. Is it looking political in any way?
You know, I haven't actually seen the ceremony because that's behind barricades and such, and I've been out behind the barricades so I can talk to people as they come in. You have to take a vow of silence, as it were, in order to get into the ceremony. I'm sure it's not political. I mean, they take this very seriously, I think. You know, the usual arrangement of dignitaries. Of course, Vice President Biden was new this year. Probably didn't have quite the same political overtones as it did last year when both Obama and McCain showed up, and there was some, you know, discussion of whether or not this was a platform for their presidential campaigns or not.
WNYC's Matthew Sherman at the World Trade Center site for the annual ceremony. Matthew, thank you very much.
Thank you, Brian.
We'll go to a break with a little Bruce Springsteen music from his 9/11 album, The Rising.
Now the sweet bells of mercy drift through the evening trees. Young men on the corner like scattered leaves. The boarded up windows, the empty streets. Are my brothers dying?